The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 4th of July, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Carl Sterrett, Chief Executive Officer of Shield Therapeutics. STX is the ticker there, and Carl discusses progress on their lead drug and a big milestone which could occur this month. Also on the podcast, Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com, covers Persimmon, Associated British Foods, and Sainsbury's, all with a bit of news out. Plus, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about Arc Minerals, Keras Resources, and Bushveld Minerals. And as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Carl Sterrett, Chief Executive Officer of Shield Therapeutics. STX is the ticket there. Carl, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, and do you know what? You just reminded us. The last time we spoke, you were on a plane, I think, heading to the States, maybe, I think it was, and still working last minute before they say, please shut your phones off, and it was very nice.
Indeed.
So let's, before we get into some things, I mean, maybe one of the reasons why you went to the States, but before we get into the detail of where you are in the company, just give us a brief summary. Shield Therapeutics, for people not aware, tell us all about it, if you could, Carl.
Certainly. So Shield Therapeutics is a specialty pharmaceutical business. So we develop drugs that target patients with an unmet medical need and perhaps are initially treated by the hospital specialist rather than a general practitioner. And we have a lead product which is approved in Europe already and commercialized, called Feraccru, which is for the treatment of iron deficiency in adults. And that drug has also been approved by the Swiss authorities. And there's an application ongoing in the United States to seek marketing authorization in the US. And the decision from the FDA, the US regulator for this, is pretty much imminent, actually. So the target date is the 27th of July. Which, ironically, is a Saturday, so I'm sure we won't be hearing on a Saturday from a from an agency, a government agency, but it'll be somewhere around those dates, we expect. Okay. It's not set in stone, but it's the target date.
But it's close, and it's a big milestone. So okay, cool.
It is.
Yeah. So talk us through the strategy, because you've got a strategy there of licensing out to third parties. Can you explain? I know. Why you do this? What's the other option? But why do you do this, please?
Yeah, I think generally there are two options. You can either go it alone and build your own marketing and sales infrastructure, or you can seek commercial partners. And actually, we started off with the former route, the idea being that with a product like Feraccru, where iron deficiency with or without anemia is so common in a number of diseases such as gastrointestinal diseases or nephrology diseases or cardiology, the elderly, you know, the list goes on, that if you were trying to, if you could raise enough capital and then you could build out the commercial activities of a product like Feraccru, you could then bolt on other products in those other areas so that you were getting a lot of efficiency for your sales reps. I think in reality, when we first launched the product, we never really had enough capital to go at that as aggressively as we really wanted to. So we took stock of that whole situation, knowing how good a product Feraccru is, and that really, for it to be successful, it needs to share a voice, because the leading product is already selling about $1 billion a year in this space. So it's a huge opportunity. So we decided to have a change of strategy, and we have now partnered in Europe with quite a significantly sized specialty pharmaceutical business called Norgine. So they have about 1,200 people. Mm-hmm. You know, we had 60, 70 at the biggest we were. They have already in Germany 50, 60 reps selling Feraccru. We had 10, 12 reps. So you can just see the ability to amplify the noise around Feraccru really requires that critical mass. So a change of strategy, And now we're starting to see that progress with the product, because it really is quite we believe it's quite an outstanding product.
Yeah. And so how is commercial sales going? Is it going well?
Yes, so it's early doors for Norgine, and they really started on the road in Q1 of this year. They've got to raise awareness again. There was sort of a hiatus through 2018, but certainly all of the qualitative feedback we're getting is very positive. And as and when we get some numbers that we think early on, you're always going to get quite sort of sawtoothy type progress. And as long as we've got a long enough period of time to show the trend line is very much on the upside, then we'll be happy to report that. Yeah. But it's still early days. However, I would stress that the feedback we're getting is we're very pleased with. And this is clearly a vanguard product for them. It's the first product their reps talk about. Their reps are highly incentivized on the product as well. So I think we've got a really good partner. And there's a good collaborative relationship with them, which is essential because we're like a married couple in some ways. We have to work together, live together.
Yeah, exactly. Just going back to the milestone, the FDA, you did mention it's the 27th of July. It's a weekend. Governments don't work on weekend. And of course, started this year, we had government shutdowns in the US. So you're expecting some kind of, maybe I'd assume it's going to be after that date rather than before. We know all the governments don't work faster. They work generally slower. So do you have any idea how long maybe after that date it's going to come out? I mean, are we talking weeks? Are we talking months? What? Days?
So I think at the moment we're hoping that it'll be on or around the 27th. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. It's probably unlikely that you would get something early. And seeing as the 27th is a Saturday, maybe it's the following week. But on or around, we've had no indications of major holds at all. So we've answered all of the questions we've been asked. We've reached agreements on a range of issues that just through the review process, where maybe the agency has a particular view on something, and we've addressed those questions. And this is just very, very much the norm. It's part of the to and fro of a full review of the safety, efficacy, and quality in the sense of manufacturing and all the reproducibility side of that manufacturing. It's just a normal ebb and flow of a prescription or of a new drug application. So there's nothing there that we consider to be an anomaly. And a number of us have been through a number of these. So we've got quite a lot of experience of this.
Yeah. And so, what are you expecting to get back from that? Will it be more toing and froing after that? If once you get the review back for them, or is that straight on to then towards commercialization? What happens?
So ideally, we will receive a letter from them that says the drug has been approved for the grants and marketing authorization, mm-hmm. and then the drug can be sold commercially in the United States. So to line that up, and the US is just an enormous opportunity.
Yeah.
To line that up. We have been working with an advisor to identify a range of potential partners, and the aim is to have a shortlist at the point of the FDA's decision, and then in some ways you sort of start the fire, you fire the starting gun, and then it's the first one over the line becomes our partner, and they will already have been pre-approved by us as appropriate partners. So we want to get that done as quickly as possible. Because in the end, every day of delay to launch is a day off the end of sales. Mm-hmm. So we really want to push that forward as aggressively as possible. So it's those two things have been very much running in parallel, working closely with the FDA or as close as we can and answering their questions as quickly as we possibly can. And at the same time, going through those discussions with potential partners so we can try and those parallel lines converge very shortly after the approval of the FDA.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, so it's a big quarter for you. So finally, Carl, three reasons, please. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing, the progress you're making, but are not following the story as yet, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Sure. I think, first of all, we are in a company that already has a commercial product, and we have a great partner already commercializing the product in Europe. So when I look at the US, yes, it's a great opportunity, and yes, it provides significant upside. but we already have a business as well. And that's, I think, really important to remember. So very much in a de-risked environment here. So the approval in the US should give significant upside. We're also doing the same in China. So we're quite along the way down the road with some potential partners in China with the same idea that we'll have a licensing agreement. And all of these license agreements come with, generally, you'll get a material upfront payment for the license, and then there'll be sales and development milestones and also royalties. And if I look at our European deal with Norgine, so we've now taken about £13 million in cash upfront from them. Plus we've got about another 50 million odd euros in sales and development milestones, and then critically all the way out through to the end of the license agreement, at the end of the patent life of the drug, we get royalties ranging from 25% to 40% of the sales. So that can generate, you know, as the product goes through to peak sales, that will generate a lot of cash. So I think de-risked, a really excellent product, and a number of catalysts coming up over the next few months that really should drive that value.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Carl, good to chat to you. Like you say, big quarter coming up, so no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. And you've been orbiting the planet pretty much, haven't you? China, California, God, jet set, Chris.
Don't tell me about it. I mean, one, obviously, I hate to think about my carbon footprint. You've got to think about these things nowadays. It was fascinating. Don't get me wrong. You know, the world's in an interesting point at the moment. And to actually go to two of the big protagonists, to drop down into China, to go over to California, which I know is not wholly indicative of the States, but kind of an interesting place, to actually do stuff that included having a test drive in a Tesla, which was truly fascinating.
Which model was that?
It was a Model X. It was an absolute beast. Yeah. I mean, the car was $90,000 and dollars, and it was a wonderful looking car. My only observation is that I did enjoy the autonomous system. I was slightly scared though when over an intersection the car sped up, and the other person in the car and I looked at each other and decided that maybe the Tesla system wasn't for us. But
it was on autopilot, was it? And then all of a sudden
it was on autopilot. Because the thing was, if you're a human, you go over an intersection, you know, like a crossroads or something, you know, it's a green light, it's good to go, but you're just a bit cautious, aren't you? Kind of hold back a little bit. But this Tesla, what it did is it flicked it straight up to the speed limit, which was 40 miles an hour, so it wasn't breaking the law, but it was right bang on the speed limit, and it just felt unsafe. Yeah. And you know, it's as I say, I wasn't the only person to feel that. And
it's a binary reaction of a computer. They don't have caution. They either go or stop, you know.
That's it. And so in a weird way, if every car was a Tesla on the road, you would be relaxed about that because you assume they would be talking to each other. But what I learned from my research is, you know, I wasn't having fun just driving around in autonomous cars for no reason. You know, there was an actual serious element to all of this. And the serious element was that, and it's actually come out in the last few days, that Waymo, who are owned by another autonomous automatic car driving company, who are partly owned by Google, have actually got the technology which, you know, if you like, induces things like human caution into their aspect. So that's all quite interesting. Anyway, wonderful experience, very interesting, but I'm not buying one soon.
Yeah, well, listen, even though you've been flying around, at least you jumped into an electric car, which is reduce your footprint a little bit, you know? So
that's right.
Who knows?
That's true.
Let's go on to companies then. What company's got news out, Chris?
So got to start with Persimmon in the house building sector. Trading update today, a trading update with reference to the half year numbers, which will be out later in the summer. But kind of interesting. Because obviously I've been a recent bear of house builders over the last year or so. You know, as a call, that's worked out pretty well. As always with sort of bearish calls, the question is, do you carry on or do you jump off, book some profits or whatever else? And on this one, I think I'm going to carry on being cautious. And I say that for a few reasons. The first reason is that the half year numbers superficially seem all right. There's talk of reiteration of numbers. There's talk of margins being maintained and stuff like that, which all sounds good. However, if you take a close look at the numbers, you can see a few things. Both revenues and sales of houses are both down sort of 4-5% year on year. We know that the housing market's under pressure. We know that things like multiples of house prices to underlying incomes is kind of a bit bonkers in the world, in the UK at the moment. But most importantly, that the company, it's done a very, what I would call, good PR job in the numbers today, of talking about how they're actually doing a lot more for their customers, how they're helping out the government by building lots of starter homes and first homes and stuff like that. But ultimately, the reason they're doing this is because a few months ago, the company was roundly criticized for its lack of controls, its lack of customer care and related. They had to reluctantly agree to an independent review of all of those care issues. That will be reporting at the end of this year, in the last quarter of 2019. So that's still to come. They're obviously talking a big story about how they're making internal changes and everything else. But I think this is a cloud that's still hanging over them. And it's a cloud which I reckon has got to be ultimately margin dilutive, just because of the compliance costs I think they're going to have to incur in order to build better homes, more sustainable homes and everything else, get away from some of these criticisms that have been running around in the press. So my view is shares fell back below £20 in the last couple of days. I think they are going lower. I think they're staying below this 20 quid level. My guess would be they'll be lower by the end of the year.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I looked at a chart yesterday, in fact this morning, which is IUKD, which is a dividend-paying paying ETF, and I think Persimmon is one of the holds they have, because it pays dividends, decent dividends, I think, doesn't it,
Persimmon? Yes, that's right. No, capital returns have been good, you can't argue with that, yeah.
And the chart looks very similar here. That had a big sell-off in Q4 last year. It down to almost 18 quid per cent. It rallied then, subsequently to 24, 25 quid nearly. And now it's back down that level. Now, it'd be interesting to see if it holds that. So, it hasn't gone down that level. It's 19.50 at the moment. That was 18 quid. So it'd be interesting to see if this is a higher low and it just builds from here. Because this IUKD chart is the same. It's a bit more advanced than this, but it did the same thing. It retested that low from Q4 and it's starting to grind a bit higher now. So it'd be interesting to see if it plateaus here, goes lower or goes higher. Because I think that there could be a... We'll see. I mean, do you know what? There's been a lot of people criticising. I mean, they don't mention the dividend, do they, in the trading update, which is that a worry for people?
It's right at the bottom. There's a little bit of about capital returns. And to be fair to them, the fuller half-year numbers in August will, wax lyrical on EPS and dividends and other projections and forecasts and everything. Although clearly a trading update, if there's anything material to say, that they would have said it. So you can kind of assume that, broadly speaking, they're hitting people's forecasts. But as always, it's where a stock's going in terms of broad profits and cash flow generation, but also the kind of the issues impacting the sector at the bigger level. That's what really matters. Historic numbers can only get you so far always with a share price.
Yeah, exactly. No, but this is an interesting level here because, everything else being equal, if I saw another share like this, it's approaching buy zone here, but maybe there's some...
Yes.
Like I said, but the outlook is not bullish, really, isn't it? They're saying they are guiding a bit lower, maybe. So we'll see. Plenty of time with all stocks, isn't it? You can sit back and wait. It's not going to take off
precisely,
like crazy.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say is, a lot of value investors like this space because, as you say, they look at the dividend yield or they look at the historic headline low PE ratio and think, my goodness, there's value. But of course, you've got to get your mindset into where a stock's going. And, I think that's why I would exercise caution with this space. I think there are alternatives in the broader UK market, things which also pay good dividend yields, which actually might be a bit more appealing. But, we shall see.
Yeah, exactly. What's next, Chris?
Well, another quick update, this one from AB Foods, Associated British Foods, obviously a well-known name with lots, a really wide range of goods they're associated with, some of which aren't foods inevitably at all. Well-known, obviously, historically for things like sugar production, sugar beet and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they've got a food and ingredients business, Twinings Tea and matters like that. But they've also obviously more recently, over recent years, been very famous for building up Primark. And if you look at the numbers today, it's a right old, what I would call some of the parts kind of a mess. You've got Primark still doing a good job, broadly speaking. And I have to say, the local, the one that's open near me locally, is a pretty impressive store. You know, I'm clearly not its core clientele. I don't really understand it when I, if I pop in there, you know, why the hell should I really pop in there? But in terms of just my observations on how busy it is and related, how many shopping bags I see people, you know, walking away from the store with, it certainly seems if it's attracting a certain core clientele. So, you know, Primark's still good. The sugar business is still shabby. That's linked up with a variety of things, including the inevitable Brexit, but other sort of broader, bigger commodity trends globally, and the rest of the businesses are kind of all right. So it's a right old sort of a bit sort of good, the bad and the ugly type sort of combination. And, you know, I look at it and it's funny, the Western family, who are big shareholders here, effectively have a blocking voting stake on the company. You know, they've been, you know, good stewards of capital for many generations, and a lot of people like the share for that reason. But I look at it today and I think to myself, it's trading on you know, a high teens PE ratio. You are getting a bit of a dividend yield, but you've also got a messy sum of the parts. I think what would really kick this one into the stratosphere in terms of the share price would be clearly spinning Primark off. But my feeling is, in a way, that the sort of the conservative nature of the Western family just means that they're unlikely to do that. And so at this level, I would say, why bother with AB Foods? You know, there's no compelling need to buy the shares or anything. I'm sort of chilling on it.
Yes, it is odd. So is that why? I mean, because they've had lots of pressure, I assume, to spin that off, because it doesn't make, they say there's so many different parts of that, and that would create a lot of value on its own. But are they ever sort of, I'm not being over the story there, but have they acknowledged the fact that there's a lot of people saying you should spin that off or not?
They are, but they're a very old school company. And, you know, you can tell that sometimes by the name of a company, you know, Associated British Foods. You know, it sounds as if it's sort of almost Dickensian or something like that. And, you know, that's very much how they run it. If you interact with the company, look at how the even the PR releases are come out, the feel you get from the website, let alone if you do a site visit with them or something. You know, it is a company where there's a certain style, and it isn't quite kind of the norm for sort of a 21st century FTSE 100 company, who tend to be, you know, super sharp, very, very technologically astute, very PR astute and related. This is cut from a slightly different cloth. So there's no doubt that they're good business people. You know, that the clearly the building up of Primark was a genius move in hindsight. However, I think they also quite like their sort of iconoclastic kind of reputation, and sort of pandering to investment bankers who want to spin off one of their businesses is not really up their street, I would say. So I think for this one, you could wait a long time for there to be a spin-off. I just don't think it's going to happen. And therefore, on that basis, I'm kind of chilled on the stock. You know, there's a pretty big old rating on it for a range of businesses, some of which are good and some of which are less good at this moment in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Marvellous stuff. And it's interesting as far as the range is concerned. Since 2000,
it's in the middle, isn't it?
Yeah, start of this year. Yeah, exactly. It's gone from 20, 26. At the moment, it's at 24.5. So it's right in the middle.
Yeah.
I, you know, if you're going to be a buyer, wait for towards 20 quid, really.
Precisely. That's right. Yeah, it's a deep sort of, you know, shrug of the shoulders. But, you know, they came out with numbers today. It's a big old name. Might as well have a quick think about it.
Yeah. Anything else there, Chris?
Well, talking about family of sort of businesses and family, historic family management teams, Sainsbury's obviously, you know, used to be a very family-run business, not so much as per the last few chief executives, but they came out with a little update yesterday. I thought I'd just comment quickly on it because it is a company I have, you know, thought about and talked about in recent months, obviously primarily around the unfortunate failing of their attempted deal with Asda, which I think, you know, and I could, it's funny, the shares have fallen sort of still a further 10% since the Asda debacle was announced a few months ago. And I think the reason why is this a company still searching for a strategy? The trading statement yesterday was all over the place in the sense that they talked about cutting the prices of 1,000 core products, trucks, and yet the taste, the different sort of premium brand was doing all right. So, you know, it's all over the place. They're still searching for a strategy at a time when obviously competitive conditions are pretty tough, and obviously competitors are pretty aggressive, be it the German discounters, be it recovering Tesco's or another. I tell you what struck me as interesting today, and why I think that Sainsbury's are still it's uninvestable, even though it's fallen to sort of around about the £2 level, which does look superficially quite cheap. I saw their erstwhile merger partner Asda announced actually what sounded a pretty smart deal with Just Eat, and that they were going to sort of not only deliver pizzas, which I think was a trial project that they started a while back, but also they were going to introduce sort of a relatively restricted line of groceries, you know, 50 or 100 different groceries you could get delivered to your house via the offices of Just Eat or one of their kind of delivery capabilities. And I thought to myself, this is just what kind of a supermarket should be doing, you know, forging these alliances and deals to sort of get in front of customers in ways which perhaps people are using it much more than just rocking up to the supermarket once or twice a week, as we would have done, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. And Sainsbury's have got a capital markets day in September. This is their big moment to come up with their recovery plan. Until then, the shares are in limbo, and I reckon they'll be, you know, within 10 pence of 200 pence a share, you know, for that period, you know, a little bit above, a little bit below, just depending probably on the market winds. But yeah, I thought it was interesting given the Asda news today. I looked and I thought, my goodness, I bet Sainsbury's would love to be, you know, deep in 100 different committees about how they're going to make, you know, Sainsbury's and Asda work and sing together, etc., etc. You can just feel from their statement yesterday, the heart was ripped out of their corporate strategy, and they still don't really quite know how to kind of recover from it or kind of move on from it.
No, it's just lows, bouncing the lows. It's let me just look at this. It's had a couple of days bouncing here from a pretty much, what is that low? It's like scrolling the chart back to 2015.
Yes.
2000, in fact, you know what? I have to just grab the chart and drag it back. Yes. 2008. Wow, so it's now at an all-time low, pretty much 2008, because that's during the financial crash. So it's down that level. So £2, it's like a bounce there, but it's a technical bounce. It's not like it's a fundamental one. Who knows what they can do?
Wait for the September capital markets day. You know, Sainsbury's has a loyal audience. I think they naturally struggle in times when competitive conditions get a bit tougher, because a lot of their audience tends to be quite aspirational, you know, sort of that classic sort of upper middle class type of orientation. You know, the value buyers or the premium buyers maybe go elsewhere. But, you know, they have good locations. I actually think the Asda thing would have been quite fascinating to watch. That would have been good for everybody in the sector, in my opinion. But obviously the competition authorities took a different view. I think actually the wrong view personally. But as I say, They need a strategy. There's no need to participate in this one until, let's see what they say in September, and let's judge it after that. You know, that's what the professionals are going to do. I think, you know, private investors should do the same.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Chris, thanks for that, fella. And are you in this country next week, or are you somewhere else?
Not planning to augment my sort of emissions and CO2 carbon footprint or whatever else in the near future, thank goodness. So I'm going to ride my bike to try and sort of scrap a few carbon units back or something, I think. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, well, listen, we'll catch up next week, fella.
So the plan.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now, live from the country, is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. All right, John, having a few days in the countryside, are you?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it's nice to have a couple of days off.
Yeah, it's nice to get out of the office, isn't it, and away from it all. But news is still with you, though, I see. And what are resource stocks looking like at the moment? Because, of course, we've had some positive news from the Trump-Xi sort of camp from the G20 meeting, haven't we? So are they bouncing? Are commodities, you know, rallying? What's happening?
Well, the news on the resumption of talks was good for commodities. And what's been extraordinary through the last 6 months is, whilst commodities have had drifted lower when we look at copper prices and other metals, actually the commodity stocks, the junior miners, have held up remarkably well. So there's been no collapse in the sector. What it says to me is that there is underlying strength, and there is definitely underlying value creation in a lot of these companies. I think there's been quite a lot of investor attention on Rio Tinto and BHP, quite rightly, because of the extraordinary earnings and dividends that should flow out of those companies, just because the iron ore price has been so much higher than normal. And that's down to the terrible disasters that Vale had in Brazil. And those iron ore prices are still right up there. So that is very good. That means more money in the sector and hopefully better times for the junior miners ahead.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I'm just looking right now. When was this released? Oh, they're going to resume talks next week. Yeah, so, okay. We'll see what comes of that. But at least now, the language has been turned down a bit, hasn't it? It's been reduced. It's not so threatening, well, you know? It's almost like, from afar, when he's on Twitter and he's not in their initial environment, he's not close to them, he's a bit threatening. And then all of a sudden, when they're going to get close together and actually talk, he sort of ramps it down a bit, doesn't he? You know?
Well, he does, and then he ramps it up again because he suddenly said he was going to put tariffs in against the European Union. And he mentioned Scottish whiskey and Roquefort cheese and a few other things. So I don't know if that's because of lobbying within the United States and a bit of pork barrel politics, as they say, or if that was just Trump wanting to shake things up within the EU. Yeah. And we know that the US would love to do a trade deal with the UK, particularly Donald Trump anyway. So he may be starting to get involved. And that did worry markets a little bit. The good side to that is that it's more likely now that interest rates are going to get forced lower, probably in the US, almost certainly in Europe, and maybe in China as well, because of all these trade issues. And lower interest rates seem to be good for commodities, and that should be good for mining companies.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's dig into some individual stocks. John, what are you looking at?
ARC Minerals is my favorite small copper junior stock at the moment. Yeah. A new discovery, as far as I'm concerned, at what's called Shazaya in Zambia. Very good results from the first drilling. 20 meters at over 1% copper, as I remember, in the first hole, and that's just from 2 meters under the surface. So, I mean, spectacular to have that kind of success rate on exploration. It's clearly a target that sticks out like the proverbials. And it looks like it's going to have some quite good scale as well. Though we never quite know till the drill or the truth machine, as we call it, defines what the target's going to be or what the resource is going to be. But it certainly looks very exciting from this perspective. And I think the chief executive was really quite understated in his comments.
Yeah, I like that. The truth machine, the drill or the truth machine, as we call it. And I suppose, you know, that's been used in torture scenarios as well. Right, let's get the truth machine on him. Okay. Do you know what? It's a nice jump in price, John, recently, isn't it, Ark?
Well, it should be. I mean, I think there's a huge amount of new value to come out of that company. I mean, if Shazaya turns into a decent-sized discovery, then ARC Minerals is going to be worth at least 10 times what its current market cap is. So it's got a long way to go.
Well, it went down like the low recently of 2.2. And in the last 6 sessions, it's gone from 2.2 to 3.6. But there lies a bit of resistance. But it's nicer. It's punched above what's called the 200-day moving average, which is a very strong... It's the biggest of the moving day averages. It's the bull bear line, so it's above that now. So it may come back to that, but maybe we'll see a bit of support and maybe a change in direction of the share price here. What's next, John? Anything else there?
Keras Resources mentioned earlier this week that they are going to... that they are now free to trade shares in Calidus, mm-hmm. and that they're going to distribute those shares in Calidus. And in fact, the Calidus is an ASX-listed gold exploration company, which is about to produce a pre-feasibility study on its project. So I think Calidus shares are going to go up anyway. And actually, Keras owns a certain number of Canada shares that are actually worth more than its entire market capitalization. So investors are in for a bonus windfall, shall we say, because they're going to get a load of free trading shares in a company that's worth more than their existing shares are worth. Yeah. Now, underneath Keras is a manganese mining project in Togo. They're just waiting for the government to sign off on the mining license for that, and who knows how long that takes in a country like Togo, because there's not much precedent for it. But that's a nice project. That's worth substantially more than the market cap on its own, in my view. So this company is, again, very substantially undervalued and with a good future.
Yeah, sometimes if I can't picture where a country is on a world map in my head, I tend not to want to invest there. You know, maybe it just worries me sometimes. I'm a bit careful. I mean, with resource companies, you often have to go outside your comfort zone geographically, don't you, to find those bonanza gregs and commodities, you know?
And we often find that these smaller African countries are very open and amenable to mining. That, you know, it's important to them that they get the economy up and running. The mining brings infrastructure, jobs, healthcare. There's so many benefits that come from building a mine in a poor rural community. And some of the transformations that we've seen over the years are extraordinarily beneficial. I mean, I'm sure that there are mines where there are disasters and bad things happen, but you know, by and large, the overall positive far, far outweighs any negatives that come along.
Yeah, true. And let's be honest, when corruption does happen and a country does sort of just take control of the assets, you know, the government, it's flagged up massively compared to, you know, it's very rare it does happen. But it's worth looking at. It's actually a map, actually. You can just Google corruption index. And there's a map of let's be honest, there's a lot of countries in Africa actually that rate highly on that corruption index. But it's worth looking at that because, like I said, very far, you know, it doesn't happen all the time. Mostly, you're just dogged by delays generally, aren't you? It's nothing more than that, you know.
Okay. Always worth remembering that the UK is not at the top of that corruption index either.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, there may be a lot of corruption in the UK, but it's very, you know, maybe it's not highlighted as much. There we go. So anything else, John? Any other company news?
Well, we fiddled around with our valuation on Bushveld Minerals.
Hey, keep it clean, John.
The vanadium price had pulled back, and so we reduced our valuation on the Vametco assets. There is a benefit from the acquisition of Vanchem when that comes in, but they won't be consummating that till much later on in the year. But they do have this division called Bushveld Energy, and Bushveld Energy is very much involved with the development of vanadium redox batteries, vanadium redox flow batteries in South Africa. And so these batteries are large storage vessels for really that work well with solar power and wind power. And the World Bank has been funding for new renewable energy in Southern Africa and certainly is looking to do more of that. And so Bushveld Minerals have this business that hopefully is going to be right in the middle of all that. And so we've upgraded our valuation on that, which very conveniently offsets the pullback in the vanadium price. And it's actually quite nice to see, because I don't think we've been overly exacting on our valuation methodology. We only see Bushveld Energy as participating in about in 60% of one third of what we expect to be seen in South Africa. So we think there's going to be an awful lot of value to come out of this business going forward.
Marvellous stuff. BMN, of course, is Bushveld. Marvellous stuff. John, have a nice week. Are you spending? How long are you spending in the country?
I'll be back in the office on Monday.
Okay, all right. Are you walking, or are you to the office from there? Or?
Fortunately, they built a new rail line for us to go from Oxford Parkway straight into London. So London is much more accessible from here now.
Lovely stuff. Well, listen, John, we'll catch up next week, fella. Have a nice weekend.
Okay, cheerio.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Tomco Energy, TOM's ticker there. What are they at the moment? Down 5.8%. At four, Hurricane Energy, HUR's ticker there. At 3, SafeStay, SSTY. At 2, Bidstack, BIDS. And number 1, most followed company, is Open Orphan, ORPH. Worth doing some research on that company. Okay, top 5 most liked RNSs are as follows. At 5, let me just do the counting here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah. Attis Oil and Gas, Grant of Options. At 4, Makango Resources has granted new exclusive prospecting license. At 3, Predator Oil and Gas, Trinidad Progress Update. At 2, Arc Minerals, large new target identified at Samsort. And of course, John talked about that on the podcast. And number 1 is Infrastrata, Strategy Update, INFA. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.